David Ossington is in the Pocket is sponsored by the School of Rock Mainline and Kroger Percussion. I'd like to thank the School of Rock Mainline, located at 511 Old Lancaster Road in Berwyn. You can visit their website at schoolofrock.com. Ask for Dave Marsh or Rick Allison. I'd like to thank Kroger Percussion at KrogerPercussion.com at /ITP, and it'll bring you to a website. You'll get a 5% discount. Call Eric Metz at 215-669-8588. That's KrogerPercussion.com. Everybody, welcome to the David Ossington in the Pocket podcast. This is podcast number, if I'm correct, I think this is 95. 95, wow. It's hard to believe sometimes, but here we are on August 11th it is today, Wednesday. Beautiful day here in New Jersey. I'm looking at my friend Mike. I'm really excited about today's podcast because the topic today is something we could go on forever because I'm such a big fan. One of my guests today and his great new book. But first off, before we get started, I do want to say one quick little shout out to a friend of mine that I've been visiting. This great drum shop. It's not a corporate drum shop. You could go in there and buy a wheelbarrow if you want to, but find some really cool drums. It's a place called Pocket Percussion in Doylestown. It's at 1628 Swamp Road. You could call my friend Keith at 267-804-5936. It's a really great place, and he does a hang there on Saturday with a bunch of drummers, and we just kind of vibe out and, you know, hear some cool drums, and it's just a really great place. So please, if you have some time, and if you dig drums, go check it out. So that brings me to my guest. And today, my podcast is with Mike Edison, who over social media, we've become friends. And I'm a huge, huge fan of this book that he wrote. The book is called Sympathy for the Drummer, Why Charlie Watts Matters. And I'm such a huge fan of Charlie Watts's, and Mike wrote this book that was absolutely fascinating. Mike, great to have you here, man. How you doing?
Thank you, man. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah.
I love, Facebook friends become friends IRL, right?
Yeah, baby. Yeah, absolutely, man.
So, I was really glad to hear from you. I've been digging everything you've been doing.
Oh, thank you.
Online as well, and you're a drummer's drummer, man. So,
oh, thank you. Man, I'm humble coming from you.
Drummer's
read. Yeah. Well, listen, this brought me a lot of joy. I was reading this book. When did this come out? When did the book actually release? So, I know a paperback is recent, but you put it out. I like it.
So the paperback just came out like last week.
Okay, great.
Snazzy deluxe, very sexy paperback, museum quality paperback.
Yeah.
Look, you can get a good sound out of it.
you do. You can actually. This would be good on a snare drum or a tom.
Absolutely.
It's good.
You can get two and knock them together. Probably get a good sound. that's how I try to sell. Everybody next to me. It came out last year in hardcover, and we had a great run with it. I mean, everybody really dug it. It got like this tremendous response from.
Yeah.
Not only from the drumming community, but some high-minded literary people really, really embraced it as well.
Yeah.
And, of course, the best review of all came from Charlie Watts, who actually called me on the phone
saying,
lovely book. Oh, man, yeah, like right during the lockdown and everything. It was
a great
day during a dark year.
Oh. Wow.
He left me a telephone message first, a voicemail.
I hope you I hope you kept that voicemail.
Yeah,
right, there you go.
But I said to my wife, I think Charlie Watts just called me. I mean, listen to this. He's like, hello, you don't know me. I'm looking for Mike. My name is Charlie Watts. I want to thank Mike for writing this lovely book and for putting Charlie Parker on his answering machine.
Right?
It's great because I had this Charlie Parker little blip on my outgoing voicemail, like since I got my first flip phone, for like 5 years.
I
just never was what I was listening to that day, and I just never changed it. And he's the first person to recognize it.
Oh.
I mean, it's like 10 seconds of music.
He knew exactly what it was.
Oh, yeah, Charlie Watts. Cosmic Race. Yeah, Charlie, go. I called him back, and he was just like you imagine.
Yeah.
Just really nice. We talked about some Chicago drummers and some blues and jazz cats that I talked about that we both admired for a little while. And he invited me to come out and see them when they got back on the road, because at this point their tour had been canceled
last year. Yeah.
And of course, now we know they're going back out on the road, but without Charlie.
Which is really, and it's funny. People should know that Mike was actually booked on the podcast before this news came out about Charlie, because I was fan of this book, and I think I was reading the book. I got into one chapter and I wrote to Mike saying this book, because I love the way you articulated Charlie's playing in this book, and I think probably Charlie did too, because he probably couldn't put it into words, and you did. You know, I was just fascinated by the way you did that, because I felt like I could almost hear Charlie the way you wrote about him, the way he played a stroll and the thing he did. You know, I mean, he does, and hopefully we'll see again. But you know, I was just blown away by the book. It brought me a lot of enjoyment, and I told all my friends about it. My radio friends, my friends that are DJs, my friend Pierre Robert, who's a big Rolling Stones fan, he travels to see him and Jackie Bam Bam, they go out to see the Stones all over the world, and I told him about the book, and he went and picked it up. So, you know, it's just a great piece of writing, and you're a brilliant writer, and a great player, too. Like, I love that you play drums, and you've got a music thing going on for you, so, you know, and I bet our friend, and I'm hoping he watches the podcast, Johnny DeChristopher, because now we could see you, which is great. This is new. And Johnny knows Charlie. And I still can't believe he, but I do believe he called you back. I got to tell you one quick thing. I'm again, a huge fan, Rolling Stones fan, and Charlie's was always mystical to me. There was always something about Charlie that he kept, you know, he was, I don't want to use the word, I'm going to guarded, but there was something about Charlie that he was the quiet Rolling Stone, right? Like him and Wyman were the quiet guys. But Charlie was always so well dressed and so classy. And my buddy Mickey Curry plays drums with Brian Adams, and they were doing some shows with the Rolling Stones, supporting them, opening for them. And he said Charlie. Mickey and our good friends, and he said Charlie came in my room, walked in my room, and he sat down, and he goes. Mickey says, "Listen, I don't have a problem talking to anybody." He said, "But I was tongue tied when Charlie was there, because he was just so, my God, it's Charlie Watts, because all he pictured was the Ed Sullivan Show and seeing him like we did when we were kids watching him." Man, you know.
Oh, you know, that's one reason why Charlie Watts matters. He classes up the joint,
doesn't he? Amazing. Yeah, I wonder what's going to happen on the tour.
The rest of the band.
Yeah.
But there is this mystical quality to Charlie Watts. I mean, he doesn't really, he knows better to show than to tell. You know, he knows that, like, where it's really at is to play from the heart, not from the hands.
Yeah.
As I say in the book, he doesn't play drum solos not because he's not good enough to. It's because he's good enough not to have to.
Yeah, you know? I know.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that guy can say an awful lot in a song that most rock drummers will never find the space to breathe. They'll never find. I mean, he finds the jazz in songs like "What Comes Down" and "Respectable." Yeah. He's kind of on. Basically, punk rock. And you're listening to it. You know, for the, you know, drummers, I guess, are listening to this. You know, opening the hat in the most unanticipatable places.
Right.
And you're like, well, you know, if you can't learn it, you just got to kind of live it. You can't, it's this quality of, it's jazz. I mean, he's playing jazz within a place where jazz probably shouldn't exist.
Yes.
And I mean, in the sense of, like, you know, fusion or anything, you know, god awful, where he's forcing chops on something.
Yeah.
It's just making it swing in ways that no other mortal man has ever imagined.
Exactly. I mean, and it's great. I one thing beautiful about technology and, you know, some of these like YouTube channels and you could go back on the internet and find classic videos of the Rolling Stones, and you see Charlie. It was just like watching him has educated me as a player, because he's so, you know, I would imagine he gets ramped up when he's got to play a show, but you know, he's learned to that whole mental aspect. I you know, if Charlie was a golfer, he'd be Jack Nicklaus, right? He'd be like the guy that's so calm when he's got to, you know, shoot the putt, whatever, you know, take a putt, you know, he's just so, you know what I mean, Mike, he's just so relaxed and intense at the same time, which is always something I when I was a kid, I mistaked it for like, just being kind of aloof, but he wasn't, you know, he's so in it. Yeah.
And that's the great thing about, you know, Charlie Watson. And people forget, too, because, I mean, here we are in the first part of the 21st century. But let's go back 40 years. Let's go back to the 70s when the Rolling Stones were, like, considered a hard rock band. You know, I mean, people have gotten confused. But in 1972, 1975, in 1969, they were considered dangerous.
Yeah.
I mean, they were as hard rock band as, say, I mean, that's the world they played in, and Charlie, like John Bonham, too, even like Zeppelin and the Stones. The great thing about the Cats is, even when they're, you know, rocking out as hard as they do, they never seem like they're hurrying. They never seem like they're in a rush.
I love that. Yeah,
they're always in control. Yeah. Always driving.
Yeah,
and you know what I say in the book? It's because they get it, because it's always about anticipation and not penetration.
That's beautiful.
Let's be honest. It's all about sex.
Yeah.
It's
always about sex. They were always sex, the sexy band.
And no one wants a drummer or a lover that climaxes on the first note.
Yeah.
It's about the moment before the penetration.
Yeah.
So it's all about anticipation. It's all about the dotted eighth note. It's all about the swing. It's all about the it's almost that, you know, just waiting for that to land. It's
his playing keeps you in suspense, you know?
Yeah,
it's like, that's why you're listening to going like, is he going to go off the track? No, he's back on the track. It's just incredible.
Charlie's not a metronome. That's another, like, one of these great myths. Like, oh, you know, especially when we're kids. Oh, yeah, he's Mr. The Perfect Timekeeper.
Yeah,
there's not a single Stone song that ends at the same tempo where it begins.
Mm-mm.
Guaranteed.
Listen to Honky Tonk Woman. Perfect example, all of them. That one to me.
You know, one day experiment. Like the first, like 16 bars.
Yeah.
You know, push it through the chorus a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, the guitar solo, maybe you pull back a little bit when you come back.
Yeah.
With Zeppelin, the great example would be Kashmir, because he really faster and then he goes slower when he comes back. And
That's a funny, that's an interesting phenomenon. I'm playing some gigs this weekend, and I was rehearsing with the Hooters yesterday, and for a long time, they were talking about maybe using a click on this song Boys of Summer, and we do a version of it. And interesting thing that happened is, as because I don't play to the very end, and this whole time we've been doing this song, Mike, they said, I mentioned there's a little breakdown section, and he said, we never played exactly it's pretty precise. And they said, and I always thought they meant to slow it down there. It was like a thing that kind of happened. He said, oh, no, we just don't play it right. And I said, well, okay. You know, it's that whole thing. And they were thinking, well, maybe we should. I said, no, I always love that. I love that kind of.
Down is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. You don't make love like a metronome.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, a little rubato.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's time to slow things down. It's time for things to decay.
Yeah.
I mean, the Midnight Rambler. You know, one of the greatest.
Speaking of Midnight Rambler, I think.
It slows down. It shifts from a shuffle to a hard shuffle to a vamp. And then there's crazy stops all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, about anticipation and penetration. Yeah. That song is, you know, I mean, wow.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm with you there. And there's a bunch of things. Check this out. I think that was one of the songs I sent to Taylor. Check this out. And this is with Bill Wyman and Charlie playing. I love this. Check this out. Goose that baby. Coming. Love it. I mean, Mike, you know, like, could you, you know, and he kicks the band's ass. You know what I mean? It's like
always, every night.
That
song was like extraordinary, though. I mean, the shifting tempos. Yeah. And it's a very violent song. Yeah. You know, it's got a negative message to it.
Yeah.
I mean, people seem to forget that. And, you know, they were scary. They're singing about rape and murder. That's how they got to the end of the 60s and into the early 70s. Yeah. Everything was about you know, drugs, sex. I mean, both in the songs and in their lives. I mean, it was very, very real. It was very palpable. They weren't, you know, they still had a lot to prove. I mean, now they may or may not still be the greatest rock and roll band in the world. But I think they have a lot less to prove right now than they did in 1972. They came out every night looking to really shake up the status quo.
Yeah.
And, you know. You know, like I said, on their best nights, they should have been put in jail. You know?
I mean,
they're 72 too. It's just the pinnacle of the art. I mean, does it ever get better than that?
If you
watch Gentlemen of the Rolling Stones, it's really like, it's like, okay. I mean, can you imagine like being in another band and having to sit and watch that? I'd be like, I quit my job. What am I doing?
You know, maybe
think the whole thing, guys. You know, because it was just impossibly high level of the art.
Yeah. Yeah, they were riding a tight road every night, and it just felt good, and they enjoyed it. It was like the guys were like, oh, my God, you know, I just from the moment I saw them, I love them. And you know, through their Brian Jones time to Mick Taylor to Ron Wood, I mean, it was always like they always kept me on my edge of my seat. I can't say enough about them. It's just given me so much joy.
Yeah.
And I love reading. I had a pretty, I had a friend of mine that moved from Manchester.
So and the girls and the drugs. And I mean, you know, and I mean, Keith is so charming and funny, and he's kind of like a pirate. And I love his book. I mean, I love the fact that he, like, you know, I mean, that's, Keith's book is great because it's like, you know, I mean, it takes a guy like Keith Richards to make heroin sound funny.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, the guy seems to roll. Like,
all this, you know, when to pull the gun and when to pull a knife. Yeah. All right, Keith. Yeah. This is why I'm glad I read your book.
He rolls with the punches, that guy, man. You know, he just seems like somebody you'd like to have a beer with, you know, and hang out with. And I got friends that, you know, knew them. Both my guys, the guys I played with, worked with Mick Jagger on his solo record. And I met Mick in 1982. 2 when we opened for The Who. And that was like, I honestly remember when he walked backstage and he came in our dressing room, we were like, I felt like I was looking, it just like somebody jumped out of a comic book, like the real guy, like, you know what I mean? Like all of a sudden it was, things became brighter for me. It was amazing. You know, I remember drinking a beer we played early, 9:30 in the morning. He came back and I saw the Stones a handful of times. And, you know, every time, you know, like, and I'd hear this from people like, oh, that wasn't a good tour or a good show. And I'm going like, I don't know. It's the greatest thing I ever saw. Even what, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I've been pretty, I don't really pull any punches. You know, I mean, honestly, that's something I think people like about the book. I think it's why maybe Charlie and I hear Keith really likes the book as well, is because I don't really owe them anything. You know, I can be pretty honest about like what they're, bad records were.
Yeah. Well, what records did you not like that they
did? Oh, my God. I mean, they made a bunch of bad records.
Yeah.
Their tours are not always, inconsistent either. I mean, if you look at, first of all, they're on the ascent. So 1969, they're becoming the world's greatest rock and roll band. Yeah. That's Get Your Yah Yahs Out.
Yeah.
That's the Give Me Shelter period. It's something, it's amazing. It's something to really marvel at. I mean, they're really, really good. But the difference between 1969 and 1971, 72, when like Exile started getting to it, and they get to the film Ladies and Gentlemen, the Rolling Stones, which would be the documentary evidence of this, it's a completely different then. They are so much more vicious, so much more well-oiled, so much meaner, so much more glam in the show. Yeah. I mean, everything is just more so. Yeah. If you listen to like Rambler in 69 and listen to it again in 71, it's like, it's the difference between being mugged and being murdered.
Wow.
I mean, it's just like, holy cow. And then, it's when the few shows they did in 73 and they kind of regroup in 75, which is the record that became Love You Live, and it's still an amazing thing. Mm. But what happened is they're now becoming this arena band, right? Yeah, they've got that big British power stage and the show, and they're living in Los Angeles, and Mick's become a jet setter, and he's kind of got the bright lights in his eyes, and Keith's heroin problem continues unabated, and they coming off of It's Only Rock and Roll and Goat's Head Soup, not necessarily their best records, good records,
They were like, that was the Mick Taylor days, you know?
Mick Taylor's there. Their producer, Jimmy Miller, is starting to like drift because he's got his own dope problem, and Kevin Keith says it. You know, he was on the jet to Dopesville, and Mick was on the jet to Hollywood. Mm. And it's a great show, but it's definitely different. They're like, the band isn't like all on a tiny stage anymore. They're now playing this arena, and Mick's swinging around, and they got Billy Preston, and they added Billy Preston's percussion player. It's a much different thing. There's a lot more dance music, what later would be known as in the show. Still amazing.
Yeah,
I think. Then that's when people start saying, hey, these guys are too old to stroll, because punk rock is starting to come up in 77.
Right.
And the Sex Pistols, the Ramones, the Damned, and everybody's saying, see you later, Alligator. You guys are just dinosaurs because no one ever heard of a 30-something-year-old playing rock and roll, right? That was just the great thing is, in 78, they come out with Some Girls, and they play better than they had since, like, 1972. It's like that Some Girls tour is, like, blazing.
Amazing.
They came out of the gate ready to kill.
Yeah.
And the record is good. Listen to the document of that tour, which is also a film, Some Girls Live.
Yeah.
It's like, and if anybody is out there playing the drums who thinks it's easy to do what they do, I dare you. Take the challenge. Yeah. Try to play along with Respectable.
Yeah.
Okay? It's like, it's fast. But it was unrelentless. Yeah. It's as mean a song as they ever did. Yeah. I mean, another song about drugs and whores and God knows what. It's really mean. It's really sleazy. It's really nasty. And that means from the top down. I mean, the drums are just charging. The guitar is charging. They sound as good as they did in 72. Different.
Yeah.
This is a new version of the Stones for 1978. But in case anybody, any of the punk rockers out there are wondering if the old guys still had it, they laid it to rest. They were going to come out to stomp on you. But
I agree.
This is kind of where, to me, it drifts a little bit because by 81, they're getting back to like this corporate rock kind of thing.
Yeah.
Start Me Up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great song, but it sounds a little bit more like they're trying to attract corporate sponsors and groupies.
Right. Yeah.
The world's changed. They're bringing their families on tour. The tempos have slowed down. The sound has changed. Yeah. They're using different gear. It's a much different sound. And you can compare the records. I mean, Some Girls, like a revolution practically, and then still like sound a little bit, okay, we're putting on the show. We've already proved everything we've got to prove. Yeah. Now we're just going to show on the road. And It's not that they weren't making good records, because Tattoo You, which was odds and sods, you know, it was like stuff that was laying around. Mm. And it was like finding money in your couch.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah. Case was like finding like a tennis bracelet and a couple diamond rings. You know, I mean, amazing what a great job they did with Tattoo You. But even mixes it, but it's not of a place, because some are outtakes from Some Girls and Emotional Rescue. Some go back as far as Goat's Head Soup. They did an amazing job with it. And also Emotional Rescue, very good, great record, very underrated record.
Yeah.
But after that, it gets a little, you know, they lose focus. Mick gets into his solo career. Yeah. You know, Scott is like David Bowie complex.
Yeah.
And, you know, he can do it without the Stones. And, you know, like he says, you know, what's wrong with you, buddy? You know, why would you go out and make a rock and roll record without us?
He was pissed. He was pissed off.
He should have been.
Yeah.
He's just like, listen, if you wanted to go make a record of Irish lullabies with Liberace playing the piano, go do it. Because we can't do that.
Right.
If you're going to just go out and make a rock and roll record, you got the Rolling Stones. What are you thinking about?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where it all breaks apart. And you can see it, you know, Dirty Work's generally regarded as their worst record, you know. And it begs the question, because, you know, Keith's working like from midnight to dawn, and Mick comes
I heard about that.
Racing each other's parts. And those, you know, like, how do you make a Rolling Stones record without any Rolling Stones?
You can't.
This is what it sounds like when it comes out. And, you know, they get it back together for the tour. Yeah. And to me personally, are so big. I saw them at Chase Stadium and I guess Bridges to Babylon.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's like a small city they're building up there. It's come a long way. Six guys, you know, standing next to each other, sweating it out, really duking it out, proving something.
Yeah. I wonder about
much different presentation.
Yeah, I wonder about what it's going to be like with Steve, you know, because Charlie, it's such a huge dynamic. I know if you're going to replace bring a sub in for Charlie, Steve is the obvious choice because of his works with Keith, and they all obviously probably work with Mick at one time too. But it's still going to be weird, I think.
Well, I don't think it's going to be weird. I think there are a couple of things. First of all, he said they're calling a sub; they're not replacing Charlie.
Yeah,
and I've heard from my friends inside the castle wall that Charlie's going to get better, and we're going to see him next year when they do their 60th anniversary. And he's doing well, and this is just like a temporary setback. So, you know, blessings and you know, good healing vibes to Charlie, and Godspeed to Steve Jordan for, you know, what's got to be the toughest job in rock and roll for the next few months.
Yeah.
So I think there are a couple things going on here. One, obviously, Steve can play.
Yeah.
Two is he's never going to be able to do everything Charlie does, and why even try? He's going to have to
be him.
You know, to me, it's kind of like, let's think about it this way. So the Who, Keith Moon dies.
Yeah.
Who's like not really replaceable in any real way.
I like that's part of your book, by the way. You talk about this. I mentioned Kenny Jones has mentioned your book, and I love the way you talk about that.
On paper, hey, this dude was in the Faces, and on his buddies, and he was a mod, and let's get him. And it doesn't work because he stylistically, it is a complete mismatch. Mm. And we all know Kenny Jones has had moments of spectacular drumming with the Faces, but he is the wrong guy for this gig. And I went to see him on tour, and I'm like, this is not an authentic cool experience. It doesn't feel like it. Well, dude, lose the hi-hats, right? I mean, Keith Moon was just like, well, you're this kind of, you're very competent, but competency is not what the Who was looking for.
No.
By the time they go through a couple guys, and okay, they're playing the Who, but by the time they get to Zach Starkey, right, he gets it. I think he's a great drummer.
Yes.
You know, I want to see the Who. This is right before John Entwistle died. That's another thing. I mean, Entwistle was hardly worn in the coffin before they did the next gig. Underwriting that gig didn't want to know anything about keeping the theater dark one night. Yes, I mean, you know, not very sentimental. But anyway, Zach has got it. He understands the implications of what Keith Moon does. He has the energy and can do it without trying to be a Keith Moon copycat or a clone. He gets the energy. He gets that he's allowed to speed up. And suddenly, because like the Who work, for example, is like, it's the drummer and the guitar player chasing each other. There's no pocket in the Who.
It's actually a pocket that ripped. ripped in a few places.
But it's powder painting. When it gets going good, you know?
Yeah, indeed.
Maximum R&B and abstract expressionism. Yeah. You know, and a pop art explosion.
Right.
But Zach gets that. And suddenly Pete Townsend's playing better because the drummer is chasing him around the yard and, you know, pushing and pulling with them like Tom and Jerry, the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
And not trying to play back. He's not intimidated by it. And it works. So anyway, back to Charlie. So Steve, great drummer. He knows how to do it. He's been around the guys, played with Keith. Mick loves him. They all love him. You know, he's a good guy. But what are you going to do? You got to understand the implications of Charlie. You can't play like Charlie because only Charlie can really do that.
Yeah.
And also, it's a replacement, not a sub. So what they didn't say, like Led Zeppelin was smart and saying, hey, we're not just going to go on and call us Led Zeppelin without John Bonham. They did a couple shows with Jason Bonham, which is okay. Everybody liked it and thought it was a good experience.
Yeah.
But they didn't take, they really didn't say, go out as Led Zeppelin more than, you know, a couple times for a couple special things.
Yeah.
And say, hey, this is the same thing. Because it's not. I think it was very smart. They're not replacing Charlie. He's just, they just called the guy in from the bench, you know, for a short stretch. And I think the fans will decide whether an authentic Stones experience. I think everyone's going to have a really good time.
Yeah.
And they're going to later watch people brag about, oh, I was there when, you know, those great shows when, you know, when Steve was playing, you know, it only happened once. I was at the one of the, you know, kind of like some weird reverse kind of ride and bragging to all those shows. I think everyone's going to dig it. They got the right guy. You know, you know how it is, man. You can't stop that machine. No. They're going to go play 16 stadiums. They got, you know, a couple hundred people who work for them. They got 18 trucks outside. Mm-hmm. They've already canceled once. You can't put the brakes on this machine. I think they made the right decision. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it's a huge premise of the book that can there be a Rolling Stones without Charlie? And Keith has always said, no Charlie, no Stones.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're saying no Charlie. They're saying, hey, the show must go on. You know, I mean, and by the way, Charlie's an Iron Man. If he calls in sick to work, everybody pays it. This guy's never not been on
That's
time
what
before.
Scared me a little bit, Mike. I mean, when I heard that, I know it's, you know, like they're a massive, that's a big company, the Rolling Stones. People think, you know, I mean, that's massive. So for Charlie to call in sick meant that it scared me. I thought, oh, God, you know, because then it was the first time I thought about a world without Charlie Watts. I thought that. And that's a frightening thing for guys like us.
Anything, but we're going to be living in a world without Rolling Stones. I mean, it's going to happen in our lifetimes, and we're going to have a world without Bob Dylan, and we're going to have a world, without Van Morrison, and a world without, you know, I mean, Jesus Christ, we lost all the Ramones,
People should know that you wrote the liner notes for the Ramones. You wrote this book, but reading about you is that your career has been pretty remarkable. I don't know where you find time to play music because you do so many cool things, like the High Times magazine stuff, Screw the yeah. I mean, I think that's fascinating that you do that, and then the Ramones writing liner notes. I think it was the Ramones, and did I read also that you wrote something for the Stooges as well?
It was the deluxe reissue for the Stooges' first record.
Yeah,
you find it. It's like the Rhino handmade thing. It's really nice. It's this hardcover thing. It comes with a 7-inch 45 thing with the CD with all the alternate mixes, and the book's great. It's like 16 page, really nice.
Oh, I'm gonna look it up. I'm a monitor guy. Said, yeah, I will check it.
It's actually on my website. You can read the liner notes.
There.
It's on MikeEdison.com, and there's some other stuff up there I've written, too, on MikeEdison.com. Some liner notes and a few other things I've written about professional wrestling and rock and roll. And
You're a wrestling fan. Are you a fan?
I am a very uncloseted wrestling fan.
So,
Bruno, my first job out of college, when I dropped out of college the first time, was writing for a wrestling magazine.
No shit.
And
wow.
We had such a good time. We had an office in the Empire State Building. I was like 22 years old.
Wow.
It was like so much fun. We'd go to the matches at the Garden all the time. But we also went down to the South and Texas and Florida and places. And, we hung out with Ric Flair. And,
oh, my God.
Crazy guys, you see these guys around. And it was a gasp, especially when you're a young guy. And I learned so much about show business, so much about working.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people don't get the pro wrestling thing, but to sit here and tell me you're a rock and roll fan and not understand pro wrestling seems kind of foolish to me.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, yeah. When I was a kid, I watched, I remember it was on, because I'm 65, so we only had three channels, and then when VHF started happening, I was watching the wrestling stuff on TV was great, and back then it was Gorilla Monsoon, and I remember Bruno Sammartino and Bobo Brazil, and there was a Bulldog Brower. I saw Georgie Animal Steel, and I still remember all those guys. I think Haystacks Calhoun. Every Saturday morning, I was in front of that TV, Mike, watching it.
Has those great memories. You know, I mean, to me, wrestling now, it's not funny anymore. So I kind of I've drifted. I don't watch. I mean, I'll tune in to watch WrestleMania, but they do this. It's just a little not as funny. The gimmicks aren't as funny. It's a little too self-serious.
Yeah.
You know, I miss the Iron Sheik.
Yeah, I mean, it was entertainment. I remember that it's like,
you know, these guys, it's gotta be funny. It's gotta be, you know, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, I think that's, you know, the great thing about Keith Richards is he gets this sort of macro joke of the universe.
Rock and roll.
I think Bob Dylan's got an amazing sense of humor, you know?
Yeah.
And the serious art that he made, I think was a very funny guy and got this, like, he understood what it was to be David Bowie. It wasn't, you know, I think with Mick, here I go. Sorry, Mick. Sometimes you get the Mick that Mick thinks you're expecting and not the Mick he definitely wants to be. And somewhere along this feedback loop, you're seeing the Mick Jagger, you know, that we've all come to imagine, the world's greatest frontman, the greatest rock star in the world.
Yeah.
He is without a doubt. And, mm-hmm. and you know, he's one of the great lyricists of all time and no better worker in the history of the sport. But with Mick, everything's got to be larger than life, you know, at all times, you know, or so it seems. I mean, he's, you know, not 80 years old yet. He's getting goddamn close.
It's hard to believe.
Like a teenager.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of weird because if you look at the shows in 72 or whatever, he was like not running back and forth doing 10 miles a gig, you know, and it was very, very powerful.
Yeah.
And Bob just turned 80, and I don't know if you've been seeing it, what he's been doing lately. I mean, he's a new version of Bob Dylan, but a very real version of Bob Dylan, but it's the 80-year-old Bob Dylan, and it's very sexy.
I got to check it out. Yeah.
You know, he does it without having to act like a teenager. So, I mean, the Stones put on this great show, but I mean, the great thing, you know, like the last Stones, I guess this is the last studio record, is that blues record, right? Blue and Lonesome, mm-hmm, which is so good.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I know.
It was like unexpected because their last record of originals was like, you know, it's, you know, Mick always wants to bring in the hip hop producer, you know, because it's going to be the thing.
Yeah.
And Keith wants to play roots and reggae and American rock and roll.
Right.
And, you know, why do I need a hip hop producer here? We're already the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
And Mick likes to make the record he heard in the club the night before.
Right.
Mick's the guy. Likes to invite the pop stars on stage.
Right.
You know, Keith wants to whiskey with Johnny Hooker. You know, I mean, you know, that's that. So you're never sure which Mick you're going to get. You know, Mick, the Peter Pan pop and J rock star. But then on this record, you got the Mick that we all wanted, Mick the blues guy.
Yeah.
Mick the guy who is like this incredibly good singer and musician and could settle down for half a second to make what was like, to me, a very surprising record because I thought I was going to listen to it. Sure, the Stones are going to play some blues songs, go back to their roots, so to speak, and it'll be a very droll, fun experience. And I played it over and over and over again. It was so good. And you know why, too, David? Because of Charlie Watts.
Yeah.
Man,
yeah.
You listen to the swing, those shuffles, they're impossible to play.
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, I read it a lot, obviously, in my book.
Yeah. Great book.
Fred Below, who was Charlie's hero, who was the King of Chicago Blues, all over Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, and Chuck Berry. And
you talk about all those guys. I love that in your book where you write about these cats that, like, oh, I kind of heard about them passing. And then I, of course, in your book, it became like, research time. I wanted to go back and see, you know, read more about these cats. But I love that you wrote about them in your book. We're referring back to Charlie.
Guys,
really well done.
You know, thank you. And, you know, like Earl Phillips, right, who was like this amazing, he was Jimmy Reed's drummer. And even when I was a kid, like Jimmy Reed just had this sort of throbby shuffle. And it's, but Keith loved it and Brian Jones loved it. They said, Charlie, you got to sit down and listen to this.
It's like
a pulse. And Charlie said, oh, my God, this is as good as a great jazz drummer. Mm-hmm. Because Charlie's not a snob, which really helps a lot, too. For him, it's step down playing in a blues band because he wants to be a jazz drummer.
Yeah.
Right? That's what he wants to do.
Yeah.
But he gets... And those shuffles are impossible.
Yeah.
There's a
brief
technique. It's like the Maharishi Guru of drum
right
there.
Right.
It's really hard, you know? Right. I mean, even guys who say, oh, yeah, I can play the blues. And, but you're shuffle.
Mm-hmm.
Did you learn it from an Eric Clapton record?
Yeah.
Or did you learn it from, like, an actual...
Listen to the cats, yeah. Yeah, a three-legged dog, you know. I sometimes, looking back, learning that kind of stuff, and it was almost like I was fortunate. You get in an environment with somebody that it's like in Texas. I was in Southern California around a couple guys, and they would talk to me, and the way they would talk about a shuffle, they would call it like, think about a shoe and a dryer. And then it was very interesting. And then, and of course, I always, you know, Charlie was always like, you know, I love Ringo. I love Charlie. I love Charlie just because you knew that it was the music. He came from like such an organic place, but a place that he he's so thoughtful. And I love how, you know, when you in the book, when you talk about how he started playing and that he was, you know, that whole chapter, people who was listening, you got to go read this book, because Charlie was really kind of aiming for a whole different thing. And he would have been successful whatever he did. Right, Mike?
You know. You get the idea. I mean, he quit like what was going to be a graphic design gig, and he was playing modern jazz at the coffee shop. And the Stones said, we need this guy because he swings better than the last guy.
Yeah.
And they say, hey, the second we got in, we started getting more gigs. Yeah. And it's not like they had the drummers they had. They had Mick Avery went to play with the Kings.
Mick Avery, great.
Bad drummer, but he doesn't shuffle like that.
No.
He doesn't swing. Charlie does.
No.
Charlie is a real game changer. And again, there's a show, what you and I both know, drummers only, the band's only as good as the drummer.
I agree.
And
I love that you wrote that.
He doesn't arrive like being the fully formed Charlie Watts. Mm-hmm. Like, I think with Keith Moon, you know, right from the beginning, you get an idea. This guy's going to be wild. He's going to be savage. All the time, get to, like, Won't Get Fooled Again. You could have anticipated that somehow. Yeah. This is what he does. You know, John Bonham, first note, puts up a record. You know, that huge thing, bass drum drops, boom. Yeah. You know, this is what this guy's about. Charlie doesn't really find that center till around Satisfaction. He starts stomping and stepping out. He always swing. Yeah. He always had great pace. He always knew. Yeah. He had great pace in drummers, you know?
Yeah.
He loved Jerry Allen from Buddy Holly, which he learned so much from. And, you know, he liked these jazz guys. And then all of a sudden you get to, like, 1969, and Jimmy Miller helps him out in the studio, but it's changing. Like, what he's doing on Stray Cat Blues, he's starting to do that Monkey Man.
Yeah.
He's starting to do that thing with his loping skills. And he's starting to open up in this crazy way. It's not the way he played just a couple years before.
Right.
And but to 1975, he's like, okay, this is like, wow. I mean, I think Love You Live, everything you ever need to know about rock and roll drumming is on that record. I mean, all that, like, the opening of the hi-hats, the anticipation, you know, the ghost notes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like very, very exciting. And then 1978 comes and something magic happens. He's playing differently. He's opening the hi-hat even weirder places
right.
And it comes down, and all of a sudden he's got the China symbol, right? Which comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I know we're talking drum shop here.
No. There's a lot of drummers tune in. It's fine. China symbol, that symbol that looks a little odd on the left. Lately, I know, last picture I saw, I've seen him, if I'm not mistaken, it almost looks like he's moved it a couple times, because the last photo I saw to the left, which is amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
Right on the right.
Right. Very cool. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah.
But the thing is, you know how it is, because you came up, like, you know, as being a kind of drummy nerd guy.
Yeah, totally.
You came up with, like, playing the drums like the way they're supposed to be played. And, you know, and so, come on, in 1977, who's got a China cymbal?
Like, nobody.
That's it. They got, you know, ching, ching, you know, like, some heavy metal bands, like, whanging on it because it's a special effects cymbal. Charlie brings it in and starts playing rock and roll with it. There's, like, no precedent for
it. Right. No one was riding on it. He would play it. He would be playing it.
Right. And listen to that blues record, Blue and Lonesome. This is crazy. About a Howlin' Wolf song, and there really is no precedent. He's like, like, where's that trash can cymbal? Because there was not one ever used on the Chicago blues record, and it sounds absolutely fantastic.
Ugh.
It's like, so Charlie, so now Charlie, and this is really hard to do, has become the signature, one of the signature sounds of the band.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
First, towards the core, bang, and then Charlie runs up to him and catches it up.
Yeah.
Like, before Mick opens his mouth, you're like, oh shit, it's the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. Oh my God, yeah.
You know, because they figured it out that Charlie was no longer playing with the band. He was kind of playing the band.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
I mean, he became so integral.
Yeah.
You know,
talked about Some Girls, Mike. Some Girls was, I was taking lessons with a guy named Joe Casadas in New York at that time, because I was already 20, but there were some things I needed to learn. And I loved the Modern Drum Shop. So I'd get on the train, I'd drive it. I'll never forget this one day. And this is going back to, this is 70, late 70s, and New York was a different place. And I remember I was walking up to 46th Street, and I remember listening to Some Girl. It was somebody who had a boombox. I heard it on the street playing. And I remember I heard Missing You. They were playing that record, and I was hearing it everywhere. I was walking into this drum. Oh, it was
Shattered.
Phenomenal. Yeah, Shattered. Oh, my God.
Right. great New York City songs.
It just felt like they were going to show up behind me at any moment. You know what I mean? I just felt that they were writing about, you know, it was early in the morning. I had my lesson, and I remember the hookers were going home for the night. They were walking in. Hi, because I was like this cute little kid walking up from my lesson. They're like, what are you doing? And I remember the Stones were playing, and I was like, oh, bury me now. This is the best. I loved it.
I mean, it was like the right time. It was a comeback, a totally regained them a new audience. You know, they weren't just going to be like a boomer band, which really was the thing then. It was not really, they would have some girls, they're like in their mid, late 30s. But at that point, no one could imagine like a 60-year-old Bruce Springsteen, let alone an 80-year-old Mick Jagger.
I hardly believe.
Old, you know, playing music.
Yeah.
You know, David Bowie having a career that didn't end in 1979. I mean, no one imagined these things.
Yeah.
He's still doing 4-hour shows. What's wrong with them?
it's such huge. All of them are such huge personalities to me. I just idolize them so much. And I mentioned the Mick thing, I had a weird thing happen with Mick Ronson. I was playing a gig in Sweden, in Gothenburg, and we were doing sound check, and Mick Ronson was sitting in the audience, in the chairs. Well, nobody was there, just the sound guy. And I walked off the drums, and I walked over, and I said, Mick Ronson? He goes, yes. And I remember I just felt like I just didn't know what to say. But he was another guy that I adored. I adored that guy.
I was like, you know,
I mean, seeing people like that were just larger than life. And then when he was really like this human aspect of him, like, you know, I'd love to meet Charlie. I mean, I still can't believe he called you, which is so cool.
Yeah,
but
really
I believe it when I read the book. I understand why.
And so many people in my life, and you know, a lot of stuff. But I mean, getting a call from Charlie was like, and the second I hung up, I was like, oh my God, I should ask him about this. But you know, I have a feeling, you know, I'll get to meet him. But I mean, you know, I think he likes it because Charlie doesn't want to talk about the Rolling Stones. He does want to talk about drums, though.
Yeah, he does. I know from Johnny.
Rolling Stones. He does not want to talk about the Rolling Stones. He certainly doesn't want to talk about his own personal life. He's no drama, you know?
Yeah. He was friends with Ginger Baker, too.
He was there at Altamont. He lived all the drugs, all the sex, all the craziness.
Yeah.
Right? You know, I mean, he's a solid guy, Charlie. You know, he's been, you know, married like to the same woman happily for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know, he's got some stability. I think he seems to be very stable these days. You know, being out in Connecticut, being mellow, not really boozing or drugging or anything. And, you know, I mean, it is difficult because you have to say, oh man, really? Because, you know, dudes, you're like 78 years old. And it's hard to look past that, but I know they're putting on great shows. They are putting on great shows. I'm sure they're going to put on a great show with Steve Jordan. Yeah. You have to modify your expectations because it's not going to be the Rolling Stones in 1975 or 73.
Yeah.
It might possibly be better than the Rolling Stones in 1994. I don't know. I felt some of these big stadiums are they're just so huge in scope that even if you're sitting in the front row, you're, you know, 100 feet from the band.
Right.
You know, yeah. I mean, it's kind of whoa. So I'm also at the stage of my life. Do I really need to be in a place with 60,000 other people? I mean, never mind the times we live in, just under the best of circs, you know, I really want to be in a stadium, you know, because I'm not a teenager anymore. And I've kind of, you know, I'm not jaded per se, but I've been through this, you know?
Yeah.
Do I really want to do that? And, you know, there's a lot going on. There are a lot of guys up there on stage that aren't Rolling Stones. I mean, people always say, oh, when are they going to make Daryl Rolling Stones and playing the bass? What about Chuck LaValle? He's been playing the keyboards for the
Breeders.
The guy that they should, you know, let join the band. But they didn't let the other piano player join either. In fact, Ian Stewart, they basically told him he wasn't good looking enough to be in the
I like that. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know? But, you know, I mean, he's amazing. Daryl is a great bass player, of course, but I mean, he's filling in for Bill Wyman, which is kind of like Charlie Watts.
Did you read Bill's book? Did you read Bill Wyman's book?
I mean, listen, one of the very sexy things about doing a book like this is the bibliography. That's the hot part.
Yeah.
Because I'm a book nerd, so when I have a bibliography that runs 4 pages, I'm like, yeah.
So, let me ask you about how did you go about research? Like, you knew a lot about the Stones because you're a fan, but you obviously had to do some research. How did you go about researching your book? Because, you know, obviously you probably have a system for doing that, but...
But when I started, you know, I had to go up to the public library, you know, and you know, take books out and use the card catalog. Yeah. You know, does anybody even remember that anymore? Now, you know, I use the Google machine, obviously, to get started, but then you got to get the books and you got to read them, you know? Yeah. And you can cross this, like, oh, you can find this. You start by looking for stuff on Charlie Watts. Like, oh, here's a Mojo magazine story about him, and maybe it's online, or maybe I got to go hunt down the magazine. Thank you, eBay. You know, I mean, research got a lot earlier from when I started my career as a journalist.
Yeah.
That's it. You start with a pile of stuff. You start with Keith's book. You start with, you know, Keith's book. You start by watching all the stuff that's on TV. I mean, David, these are like the most documented human beings on the planet.
Yeah.
There's been so much written about these guys.
Right.
I mean, coffee table books. There are fan books. Yeah. There's
basic. I mean, you always had too much. You had to narrow it down. But there was so much in this book that was so enjoyable for me, because I felt like every time I turned around, there was something new that I was learning. And I, you know, like I felt, oh, I know everything about these cats. There were things that just blew me away. It's not just choice. Yeah, right.
So, and it was never meant to be just because we've heard the Rolling Stone story, right. This has to be my own telling of the Rolling Stone story.
Yeah.
And really, I'm a good enough writer to put it over, because we've heard the story. There have been some good books about them, you know, not least of all Keith's book, which is great.
Yes.
But this is going to be my version of it. And I'm the guy who, you know, wrote I Have Fun Everywhere I Go and everything else and worked in the wrestling business. So here's what I bring to it.
I'm so glad you wrote it, man. It was like, you know, it's such a thrill to read it.
Awesome to it. And I'm not, like I said, I'm not going to pull punches, you know. I'm just going to, you know, I don't owe them anything. You know, I'm just going to be very honest about it. So it's not a puff piece. It's not a fan letter. I'm not trying to be their friends. If it happens, it's great. But that's not my goal, because my responsibility is to the audience. It's to rock and roll listeners. And then you talk about research. Well, here we go. I'm listening to what they listen to, because I love this music too.
Yeah.
I got there when I was a little kid, you know, 14 years old, straight line, Rolling Stones, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Aretha, Wilson, you know, Don Coverley, et cetera, et cetera. Listen to, you know, soul music and dance music, James Brown. And so now you start listening to this, and like you, I'm a fan of the history of the drums.
Yeah.
And I love Bo Diddley, as does Keith.
Yeah.
And you know what makes Bo Diddley great? The maracas.
Yeah.
And no one's ever a maraca player before.
Yeah.
So I'm
Mick played. Mick was the man on that.
You hear them in Sugar, you hear them in Gimme Shelter, you hear them in Street Fighting Man.
Right.
When they take off and jump in Jack Flash, the whole song seems to go like this.
Yeah.
And they got all from Bo Diddley. So I love Bo Diddley. He's like my spirit animal.
I love him too.
Talk about his drummers and sit around and listen to Bo Diddley for a while, which is I do anyway, and really start deconstructing some of the Chuck Berry stuff and the other blues guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
amazing.
Find out, like, who played on these Ray Charles records, and you find out that Earl Phillips, Jimmy Reed's drummer, oh, and he played on a couple Howlin' Wolf records. And you could tell the difference when it's him and it's with the other guy, because the pulse is a little different. It's a little more hypnotic. It's not so much a shuffle as it is this kind of like mesmerizing pulse. And it's hard to play like that. And that's why, you know, I mean, finding a good guy to play blues who's not just going to dang, 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 I have a friend who was got a gig playing with Chuck Berry one night. You know, Chuck Berry just hires his local bands.
I know about that. I know about that.
He goes, I don't want to hear one fill tonight. No rolls, no fills. Right?
Yeah.
And he goes, you know how hard that is to do?
Yeah.
I do a little like pickup on like before something. And he goes, I got the dirtiest look in the world from Chuck. I thought he was going to kill me the last time I did that all night. You know? Song once, you know?
Yeah.
You can't get in the way of the song.
Right. You're talking about Phil's. That was one of the things that I always loved about Charlie, you know, like the way he would enter a song. It was always like, you know, it's just so, no matter what, it was always some kind of, it was different, and it was always like, did I give you, Taylor, did you happen to get All Down the Line by chance? Check this out.
All Down the Line is insane.
Yeah, right? Here you go.
Kenny Aronoff wrote this for me. Do it, and he's like laughing because it's just like slightly speeds up, and the accents are in the wrong place.
Yeah.
And it's like where, you know, but it's only two bars, and you've already lost sense of where the one is.
But where
it's
like, is it?
But coming together,
right in, run together. Like, yeah.
Like, yeah, yeah. No one would ever let me play like that.
Do you have that? Do you have that, Taylor? Here you go.
You know, Rip This Joint. I really want you, because it's just I don't know how to write it.
Here you go.
I got a line.
I mean, That is grooving like a motherfucker. It's just grooving. It's so good.
You know, and it's years of listening to songs about trains and actual trains.
Yeah.
And all this stuff. And then when it comes to this filter of Keith's drug problem and the late night drinking and recording in the basement of a castle, it all comes out and you can hear the filth and dirt on this thing.
Yeah. Oh, it's the best. Hey, Michael. So listen, man, I have so much I wanted. You got to promise you got to come back.
Oh, my pleasure, Dave.
Please. I would love you to come back. Hey, matter of fact, I don't know if you're ever down this way. Maybe you come in the studio and host it with me sometime. I'd love to have you. I don't know. You're a little bit ways away. But it was an absolute pleasure, man, because you could, reading the book, I could feel you from the book, but having you on the podcast was like, wow, man, he's juiced. And it was really good, man. So you got
the book's written from a place of enthusiasm.
Yeah.
You know, it really is. People say to me, like, how long did it take you to write the book? And I'm like, 45 years. Because it started when I first started playing the drums and listening to the Rolling Stones, I had the idea, this guy's not normal, you know? I'd be sitting there playing and start out with the Stones, and look at Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix and Black Sabbath, and I'm still trying to figure out the Wizard, And then later on the Ramones, and then I sort of get my thing together. But I keep coming back to this. This is not normal, what Charlie Watts is doing. It's like, lives in a different place.
Yeah.
His sensibilities, anticipation, and the way they communicate with in the band, a lot of rock music, there's not a lot of conversation between the drummer and the rest of the band, as there is in jazz. He's figured out a way to do it without stepping on the song, without like saying, hey, I've got the blazing chops of whoever. It's not about that.
No.
It's not about that. It's still not about that.
No, it's a sheer work of art and beauty. I mean, to me, it's just like nothing better. And I when I heard about it, and I keep on promoting it, and I'll keep on promoting it. I think it is great. So anybody out there that's watching, please, pick it up. You will not be disappointed. It is a terrific way. Now, Mike, is there anything else that you could let people know about, like the website and things like that?
Yeah, find me on Facebook, and MikeKissin.com is my website. The book's available on Amazon, and, I support your local independent booksellers.
Yes.
Please. Please go down to the bookstore and buy a copy. Yeah. But if you have to, one click. Mike Edison, and I love all you guys and all the support I've gotten from Stones fans, from other drummers, and
It, man. It was really great. It was a great read, man, especially this year.
About music that musicians could dig into deep, but you don't have to be a musician. It's not about the drums. I mean, it is, but it's not. It's about rock and roll. It's about the beat. It's about groove. It's about a time and a place. It's about things much, much bigger than all of this. And I love when people tell me, when Stones fans say, oh my God, I'm rediscovering this music, or drummers say, oh my God, I thought I knew all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then when people aren't musicians say, wow, this is like, really, it's a whole new world. Like reading books like Dropping Acid, seeing it all for the first time.
It's terrific. I was honored to have you on the podcast, and I got to get you back.
It was a pleasure.
Pleasure. Yeah, thanks again, Mike. We'll catch you on the other side,
Thanks, David.
Have a great day.
All right. I'll see you soon.
Great. So, hey, Taylor, how about that? That was a good one today. So, listen, everybody, I want to thank you all. Thank you all for supporting the podcast. I thank my sponsors. I want to thank Taylor for putting on a great production today. My friend Mike, thanks for being on. And we'll see you again from In the Pocket. Boom.